Join me in the book of Acts, chapter 24. In our study of the Apostle Paul, we're at that point in his life where all of his work involving going from place to place, preaching the good news about Jesus, establishing churches, baptizing people who were believers, building up the faith of those who had made that commitment, that has all come to a screeching halt. Because just days before the passage we're at here in Acts 24, when he had gone to the city of Jerusalem, where he had once been a persecutor of Christians, and while he was up at the Jewish temple honoring his Jewish heritage, he was suddenly attacked. A crowd gathered and they start to beat him and try to kill him because they recognize who he is. That he's the one that once had opposed Christianity and now he was a leading proponent of it. And of course, some of those people who were involved in this riotous act, this vigilante action on their part, had their facts all wrong. They didn't really even understand what he was guilty of. That's often the case with mobs. They don't seek to be well informed before they act. They just act. And so some are accusing him of desecrating the temple. Some are accusing him of having brought people into the temple who should not be there. That wasn't true. Some are accusing him of causing riots among Jewish people in other places. In part, that is true, but not because he instigated the riot, but because the Jewish people rioted against him in other places, just like they're doing right now. The city of Jerusalem, including the temple area, was under the legal responsibility of Roman troops at this time. Rome ruled the world as they knew it. And Roman troops were literally stationed on the edge of the temple to keep peace. And as the lookouts look down into the temple area and see this riot taking place, the alarm is sounded and Roman troops come rushing down into the temple and take custody of Paul, protecting him from the troops, protecting him from the crowd and trying to bring about some peace. The commander tries to understand what's the issue here. He thinks at first this man he's just taken into custody might be a terrorist. And that's why the crowd is attacking him. Becomes obvious pretty quickly that's not the case. He actually asks some in the crowd, what is he guilty of? But people are shouting this and that and he can't make any sense out of what they're so upset with Paul about. And so finally, he takes Paul into the fortress that was there next to the temple. And there was a typical Roman practice, which we certainly would not want to be a part of, that said, well, if someone's guilty of something and they're not confessing up to it, let's just torture them till they confess. Of course, the problem with that, people will often end up telling you anything you want to hear just to make you stop hurting them. And so as they're about to begin punishing Paul in order to get a confession out of him, he says to them, I am a Roman citizen. Immediately everything stops. Because Roman citizens, which was a minority actually of the total number of people who lived in the Roman Empire, had special rights and privileges that ordinary people did not, including protection from torture, beatings, and other things before a court of law had duly found them guilty of something worthy of such punishment. So immediately everything changes for Paul. Certainly the Romans had no love for the Jewish people, and there are recorded cases where in trying to extract a confession out of a prisoner, the Romans had actually killed them in the process of trying to get the confession. Paul is convinced that's not what God wants for him, and so he exercises his right as a citizen of Rome, which unfortunately many people didn't have the right, to be protected. Soon it becomes clear that there's a plot among the Jews to actually try to assassinate Paul. This is how much they hated him. And the Jewish leadership is in on the plot, as we read in chapter 23. When the word of this comes to the commander of the Roman forces, he immediately arranges to have Paul transferred from Jerusalem, where all the danger was, up to Caesarea, 65 miles away, where the center of Roman authority in that region was located, and where Jewish influence was much less prevalent. And so Paul has been transferred up there. He's been transferred up to the palace where the governor, the Roman governor over this whole region, is stationed. His name is Felix. Roman governors were charged with three basic responsibilities and all the things that come out of that. Number one, not in any particular order here, but number one, to make sure that taxes flowed from the provinces to Rome. And they had to be the right amount. He was given every year a list of how much should be collected. And he was responsible for seeing that that amount went to Rome or more. Number two, he was in charge of the military forces of Rome in that region. And he was to use those military forces not only to protect Roman interests, but to keep the peace. And number three, the governor was the ultimate legal authority, like a judge, for that region. And so he was to keep Roman law enforced. Now, a Roman citizen has been transferred to the governor's palace. And so we're actually told at the very end of chapter 23 that Paul was kept under guard in Herod's palace. Now, that's an interesting comment because the place where the Roman governor named Felix is stationed is a palace that was originally built by a king a generation or so before by the name of Herod. But now this palace that had been built by Herod is actually in the possession of the Roman government, and that's where the governor is. And Paul is actually kept in the palace, not in the dungeon, not in the prison, not in the jail, but is in the palace. But nevertheless, he's under house arrest. And when we start chapter 24, Paul is going to appear now before Governor Felix, and so will members of the Jewish authorities who will come up from Jerusalem to express their charges against him and try to get the governor to act on their behalf to punish Paul, and they hope have him executed. And so we're going to hear them make charges against him that were capital crimes in their day and time. And they will try to get the governor to act then to carry out capital punishment against Paul. We need to know a couple of things about this governor. He's named Felix. He became governor in AD 52. He was dismissed from his governorship in AD 59. History records that for incompetence. He formerly was a slave. But when the emperor Claudius became emperor, you have to know a little bit about Roman history to know the background to all that's going on here. For a while, Rome had an emperor by the name of Caligula, a young man who apparently was insane. But because he was the son of the emperor, the Caesar before him, he automatically becomes Caesar when that Caesar dies. But he was insane. And after just 4 years of total incompetence of the worst possible kind, total neglect of his duties and responsibilities and very capricious acts of having other people killed and so forth, his own bodyguards execute him, kill him. Then they'd have to look around for someone else to be emperor. They didn't just have an election and somebody run for office and get elected like we do things. The only other member of the royal family that was anywhere around was an uncle, Uncle Claudius. And he was at the time considered a fumbling, bumbling fool. And the captain of the guard of the emperor's bodyguard believed that he would be someone that he and the other members of the bodyguard could actually control and influence. And so they declare him the new emperor. The old emperor is dead. Here's our new emperor. But it turned out Claudius was not nearly as fumbling and bumbling as everybody thought he was. He was actually a very competent emperor, as it turned out, and he reigned for about 13, 14 years before he mysteriously dies. It's believed he was probably assassinated, poisoned. And it's during this period of time that a man who was a friend of the family of Claudius, a slave in their household, is set free by Claudius, and he actually elevates this slave, former slave named Pallas, all the way up to being in charge of the treasury of the Roman Empire. This man was even though a slave, was a very apparently competent, capable man. And Claudius actually makes him the treasurer of the Roman Empire. But Pallas had a brother, also a slave. He was set free from slavery as well. And as a way of showing honor to Pallas, his now treasurer, Claudius appoints him governor of Judea. And his name was Felix. History records, unfortunately, that Felix was not nearly as competent for his appointment to office as his brother was. As I believe it's probably Josephus says, in effect, he said he reigned like a king, but with the mind of a slave. He was ruthless, he was cruel, he was avaricious, that is, he was constantly looking for ways to enrich himself at the expense of others. He knew very little of Roman law and had very little respect for it, because back when he was a slave, none of that was important to him, and he still acted that way. We're going to see that in the case of the Apostle Paul. This man seemed to have very little interest in seeing justice served. So it tells us here in the Scriptures, chapter 24, verse 1, 5 days later, the high priest Ananias went down to Caesarea with some of the elders and a lawyer named Tertullus, and they brought their charges against Paul before the governor. When Paul was called in, Tertullus presented his case before Felix. We have enjoyed a long period of peace under you, and your foresight has brought about reforms in this nation. Everywhere and in every way, most excellent Felix, we acknowledge this with profound gratitude. All of that is a lie. The Jews hated Felix. Later history records that probably the Jewish revolution of AD 66 through 70, 10 years in the future from this, would not have happened if it wasn't for Felix and his poor handling of his duties in Judea during the 7 or 8 years he was governor. He did thing after thing that just drove the Jewish people, who were already moved towards revolution anyway, drove them further and further that way. Because he was insensitive to their needs, he was cruel, he was overbearing in what he did. He would sometimes send troops in and just kill everybody in a crowd if they were expressing some dissatisfaction with his administration. That's the kind of man he was. And yet here's this flowery-mouthed lawyer. No insult to any lawyers who might be present. I don't think we have any. But this guy is just, buttering up the governor in spite of what the truth was, in order to try to accomplish something. So he says, but in order not to weary you further, I would request that you be kind enough to hear us briefly. We have found this man to be a troublemaker, stirring up riots among the Jews all over the world. He is a ringleader of the Nazarene sect and even tried to desecrate the temple. So we seized him. Under Roman law, desecration of a temple, even if it wasn't a Roman temple, was a capital offense. The Roman government had enough respect for local religions and their ways of worship that they had a Roman law that would protect any temple of any deity, of any religion, from being sacrilegiously defamed or defaced or desecrated by someone. And that was a capital offense. So they're accusing Paul of that. But more than that, they're accusing him of stirring up riots. This is a kind of thing that the Romans would not tolerate anywhere. And so they're actually trying to bring charges against Paul that the Romans would be in sympathy with. These aren't actually the real reasons they oppose Paul, is it? Their real reasons for opposing Paul is that he was once one of them and had helped persecute Christians, but now he's become a Christian, and for the last 20 years to 25 years has been probably the number one person to convert Jewish people over to Christianity all over the Roman Empire. And they hate him for that. They haven't been able to answer his arguments. They haven't been able to stand against what he preached, and so they just want to kill him. That's sometimes how people act. But now Paul motions for Paul to speak. And without continuing to read all of this, I hope you will read it. Now we've given you a little background to it. We hear basically Paul's defense. His number one defense, first thing he says is, they have provided no proof that I have caused any trouble at the time they took me into custody. He says, I was up at the temple showing my respects. I was alone. There was no riot. There was no problem. There was no one with me to desecrate the temple. They provide no evidence. It's one thing to make charges. It's another to provide proof. That's what Paul is saying. He does say, yes, I was once one of them, but I am now a member of the way. This Jewish sect, as they refer to it, that has come about because of Jesus. I am a member of that group. He said, but I'd come up to Jerusalem actually to show respect for my people and to bring a gift to help the poor. He said, the real people who need to be here, if they want to bring charges against me, are those who brought those charges while I was in the temple. Those people from Ephesus who recognized me from the days when I lived in Ephesus. He says, where are they? Where are my accusers? This lawyer and this high priest, he's saying, they are not eyewitnesses to anything that happened. They may be repeating charges, but they are not what law requires. The Roman law, and the Jewish law as well, required that a man had a right to face his accusers, that is, those who claimed that they were eyewitnesses to the crime someone committed. None of those are present. Paul said, in fact, the real issue here is that they disagree with me about Jesus and who he is. And it tells us down in 22 then that Felix, who was well acquainted with the way. This is an interesting comment by Luke, the author here. We don't know how it is that Felix, a former slave and now a Roman governor, could be so acquainted with Christianity, but apparently he was. So, in fact, Paul has spoken in such a way that it gave the governor good reason to understand what the real issues were. And so it says, then Felix, who was well acquainted with the way, adjourned the proceedings, and he said, when Lysias, the commander, comes, I will decide your case. So he ordered the centurion to keep Paul under guard, but to give him some freedom and permit his friends to take care of his needs. And so while not releasing Paul, he says, I need to hear a report from the Roman commander. He's the one that actually arrested you, and he's not present at this time. I need to hear from him before I finally decide your case. That sounds real promising, doesn't it? If we can just get the commander up here, we can get this taken care of. Paul can be released and go on his way and go back to preaching the gospel, have his fourth missionary journey, and all sorts of things that ended up not happening. Because while it sounds like Felix is doing the right thing, in fact, Luke tells us what really does happen. It says several days later, Felix came with his wife Drusilla, who was a Jewess. Okay, now who is it bringing all these charges against Paul? The Jews. And who is Felix's wife? A Jewish woman. Where do you think her sympathies lie? And what influence do you think she might end up having on her husband in this whole matter? There's even more we need to know about Drusilla. Drusilla was not only a Jewish woman, she was the half-sister of King Agrippa, who we meet a little bit later in the text. And she and Felix, while under Roman law were legally married, were actually living in an adulterous relationship. He had had her leave her husband to come live with him, Felix. And that's the kind of relationship they had. But several days later, Felix came with his wife Drusilla, who was a Jewess. He sent for Paul and listened to him as he spoke about faith in Christ Jesus. See, Felix already had heard quite a bit about Christianity and felt like he understood it, so he actually invites Paul to come speak to him further about that. And as Paul discoursed on righteousness, not exactly something Felix was known for, self-control, also not something was one of his strong points, and the judgment to come, that is the fact that everyone will have to give an answer to God for the way they've lived and acted, Felix was afraid and said, that's enough for now. You may leave. When I find it convenient, I will send for you. At the same time, he was hoping that Paul would offer him a bribe. So he sent for him frequently and talked with him. In other words, he wasn't actually going to ask Paul for the bribe. Paul could have gotten out of prison at any time if he would have just handed over the money. And Felix would not actually ask for that, but if Paul, by some means, would have offered it, it sounds like Felix would have taken it and Paul would have been free. Isn't it interesting? Paul's going to stand on principle on this. He will not pay a bribe to be set free. Justice needs to be served. When 2 years had passed, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus. But because Felix wanted to grant a favor to the Jews, and probably his wife, he left Paul in prison. So Paul's been sitting there for 2 years. Originally, Felix had said, well, as soon as a commander comes, this case will be over. 2 years have passed, and he's done nothing. This is part of the reason, not Paul's case particularly, but this kind of activity in general on the part of Felix is why Rome sent a new governor out and recalled him to Rome. This kind of incompetence. Now a new governor is there. A good civil servant, not a former slave, not a man with a tainted past like Felix had, but a good man by the name of Porcius Festus. It says, 3 days after arriving in the province, Festus went up from Caesarea to Jerusalem, where the chief priests and the Jewish leaders appeared before him and presented the charges against Paul. In a way, the Jewish leadership is as frustrated as Paul is. This case needs to be pushed to completion. Of course, what they want is execution. What Paul wants is freedom. Festus has just sort of been inserted into this matter, and he's not fully aware of all the background to what's going on here. He's probably not very aware of what Christianity taught. He probably is not aware of the plot that had existed 2 years before to assassinate Paul down in Jerusalem. And he's hearing from his new people he's responsible for governing over, and they're saying, look, there's a man in prison up there in your palace that something needs to be done with him. He's got all these charges against him, and Felix did nothing. And so they urgently requested Festus as a favor to them to have Paul transferred to Jerusalem. Why? As Luke says, for they were preparing an ambush to kill him along the way. If Festus had moved Paul back down to Jerusalem, in all likelihood, he would have never gotten there alive. Festus answered, Paul is being held at Caesarea, and I myself am going there soon. Let some of your leaders come with me and press charges against the man there if he has done anything wrong. It's starting all over again, isn't it? It's like nothing has happened in the last 2 years. How about an incompetent legal system? But of course, it was actually the man who was overseeing it, Felix, that had caused all that. Then it tells us that Festus goes up to Caesarea, and the very next day he convened court and ordered that Paul be brought before him. And when Paul appeared, the Jews who had come down from Jerusalem stood around him, bringing many serious charges against him, which, as Luke points out, they could not prove. And then Paul made his defense. I have done nothing wrong against the law of the Jews or against the temple or against Caesar. They've had 2 years to present evidence of that, and nothing has been presented. Festus, wishing to do the Jews a favor, said to Paul, are you willing to go up to Jerusalem and stand trial before me there on these charges? He would still be under Festus's responsibility, and Festus would just go there to hold the trial because he might argue, well, there's going to be any witnesses and other things down there that we need to hear. And Paul answered, I am now standing before Caesar's court. In other words, he's standing before one of Caesar's representatives. Where I ought to be tried. I have not done any wrong to the Jews, as you yourself know very well. So maybe Festus had done a little more research than at first it seemed. If, however, I am guilty of doing anything deserving death, I do not refuse to die. But if the charges brought against me by these Jews are not true, no one has the right to hand me over to them. For you see, again, he's a Roman citizen. I appeal to Caesar. This was an expression that meant, I demand to actually go to Rome itself. This would put a great deal of burden on the Jews, of course. That means if they were going to bring charges against him, now they'd have to travel all the way to Rome to do it. And they would still have to bring real eyewitnesses to prove the charges were true, which they so far haven't been able to produce even here in Caesarea. So Paul isn't manipulating the legal system. He's taking advantage of his rights as a citizen and demanding that they do their part, but they're going to have to do it in Rome now. After Festus had conferred with his council, he declared, you have appealed to Caesar you will go. Good, he's going to get rid of a problem. That's probably how Festus is thinking of it at this point. And the Jews still will have their chance, if they want it, to press these charges and try to bring about some justice. A few days later, King Agrippa, we have to, you know, again, it's hard to keep straight all the legal wranglings of this, but there was a part of the territory that Claudius and now Nero, who's the new emperor, had granted to this great-grandson of the old King Herod to be king over it. It didn't have a governor over it, it had a king over it. It was a part of the territory east of the Sea of Galilee, for those of us who know what that map looks like. It's a territory east of the Sea of Galilee and a small portion of Galilee as it existed in New Testament times. Plus, the Herods, and Agrippa's the last one in that line of Herods, still owned considerable property throughout this part of the world. And Agrippa was actually involved still in carrying out the wishes of his great-grandfather in finishing even the remodeling of the Jewish temple down in Jerusalem. And so he's a man of considerable influence. He's well respected in the imperial court in Rome. He is a personal friend of many of the senators and others who support the emperor. And so, out of respect for him, Festus brings him in, even though Agrippa isn't actually responsible for anything having to do with Paul. Paul doesn't have to answer to him or stand before him or anything, but Festus brings in Agrippa and said, "Look, I need to write to the emperor what the charges are against this man and why I'm sending him off to him and why I'm bothering him with something happening out here in the provinces. And because I can't quite get a handle on what the real issues are here, would you help me?" This is what Festus is saying. "Would you help me find out what the issues are here with this man so I can tell the emperor?" Well, Agrippa professed to be a Jew, as had his father, his grandfather, and his great-grandfather. But they were more of the kind of Jews who believe the prophets of the Old Testament and kind of give lip service to the Ten Commandments, and that's about it. They didn't live like Jews. They didn't practice Judaism. They weren't even very moral people. But they, if they had a religion, they would have said they were Jewish. So here's Agrippa. He's the half-brother to the wife that Felix had. Her name was Drusilla. And he's got a wife of his own. Her name is Bernice. But you need to know that Bernice is Agrippa's half-sister. This man is living in an incestuous relationship with his own sister. Remember, this is the kind of thing that got John the Baptist's head cut off about 25 years before. And now here's the grandson of that man who's in the same kind of ugly, immoral, public relationship. Nevertheless, Paul is called on to stand before King Agrippa and explain himself. And Paul gives this great message, which we're not going to read publicly here, but which you have the opportunity to do, in which Paul addresses Agrippa and says, first of all, King, you're well acquainted with Jewish beliefs and controversies, which he was because he claimed to be Jewish. He said, "I grew up a Pharisee, believing in the things that Jewish Pharisees believe, including the resurrection from the dead. And at one time, I was a persecutor of these people called the Nazarene sect. But when I was on my way to Damascus to arrest some of them up there, suddenly this Jesus appears to me on that road. And from that point forward, I have been a devoted follower of his. And I've gone everywhere preaching to others that he is raised from the dead and that he is the hope of Israel that the prophets of the Old Testament and Moses talked about." You know what Paul's doing? He is not defending himself before Agrippa. Agrippa figures out what's happening because down in chapter 26 and in verse 24, first of all, the governor, Festus, who's Roman, who knows nothing about Christianity or Judaism, is just there on as the representative of Roman authority, says, "Paul, all your learning has made you mad." He thinks the whole thing that Paul's talking about is crazy. But Paul says in verse 25, "I'm not insane, most excellent Festus. What I am saying is true and reasonable. The king is familiar with these things, and I can speak freely to him. I am convinced that none of this has escaped his notice because it was not done in a corner. King Agrippa, do you believe the prophets? I know you do. Then Agrippa said to Paul, you see, Agrippa knows what Paul's doing. Do you think that in such a short time you can persuade me to be a Christian? As one of the commentaries, I think it was a Tyndale commentary, says that we might summarize what Agrippa says in this way. In short, Paul, you're trying to persuade me to be a Christian. Paul replied, short time or long, I pray God that not only you, but all who are listening to me today may become what I am, except for these chains. The king rose, and with him the governor and Bernice and those sitting with them. They left the room, and while talking with one another, they said, this man is not doing anything that deserves death or punishment. And Agrippa said to Festus, this man could have been set free if he had not appealed to Caesar. So what are they doing? They're saying Paul's not guilty. And it is kind of interesting that Agrippa says if he hadn't appealed to Caesar, he could have been set free. The truth is, if he had not appealed to Caesar, he wouldn't be alive today, or on that day at least. Because if he hadn't appealed to Caesar, they would have transferred him back down to Jerusalem and he would have been assassinated along the way. But there's two important lessons among many that we can draw from what we're reading here. Number one, even when we're doing God's will, it does not guarantee, and there is no promise, that we'll be free from suffering, persecution, pain, struggles, or spiritual battles. We need to be aware of the fact that there are some in the Christian community who says that if we're doing God's will, God will protect us from all these things. And they try to make their hearers feel guilty if they're still struggling with things, and making them think that they must be guilty of some kind of sin and that God's allowing them to be punished for it. That's not true. Paul is living within God's will. He's doing what God wants him to do. But he's just now spent 2 years in prison, barely escaped death at the hands of the crowd, is just moments away from being sent off on a trip where he would be assassinated. He doesn't know what the future holds. We need to realize that even when we're doing God's will, God does not guarantee that we will not suffer. It's as the great Psalm 23 says, yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me. God has not promised that we won't suffer. He has promised that he'll be with us. It would be Paul himself who had written to the Roman Christians in Romans chapter 8 and verse 28, and told them that we know that in all things God works for the good of those that love him. Paul believed that even when he suffered, that God was working out his purposes. And we know that because in the verses immediately after that, he says, what can separate us from the love of Christ? And he goes on to talk about persecution, pain, starvation, attacks by enemies. Nothing can separate us from God's love for us. It's an important lesson for us to learn. All of us go through trying times in our lives, some of us very tragic times. And while on one hand we ask, why God, why have you allowed me to endure these things? We need at the same time to say, you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. The second thing we ought to learn out of this is that oftentimes it's in life's crises that God's purposes become clear, and we have the greatest opportunities to demonstrate the character that a Christian ought to have. Paul in all of this has been sterling in his character. He has demonstrated his faith. He has not backed down from that for a moment. He has not railed against others. He has demanded his rights, but he has not lashed out at his enemies the way they've lashed out at him. Instead, he's taken the opportunity to even share with those who are responsible for seeing that he gets justice. He shared the gospel with them in hopes that they might possibly become Christians as well. We'll continue the story next week. Paul is getting ready now to be sent to Rome, where he'll spend 2 more years in jail while waiting for justice to be done. We don't have control of all of the circumstances that surround our lives. What we do have control of is how we respond to them. If our center, the center of our life, is doing God's will and pleasing Him and doing the right thing, then come what may, we can still live pleasing to God. Life may not be what we expected it to be. It may turn out entirely differently than what we thought. But we only answer to God anyway.